Yeah.
But I'm the enemy of everything George Wallace said.
In that direction. We moved very slowly and hesitatingly.
For example, the franchise, the right to vote, was limited to men and men of property. But we've enlarged the franchise in the years since that time. Citizens now ineligible because of age, but also a meaningful effort to enforce the right of other citizens to vote who are now eligible. And secondly, we must reform our governmental institutions to make them more responsive and to create more opportunities for citizens to participate. Now, interestingly enough, the federal system is ideally suited to this purpose. The federal system was created in the first place as a way of dividing up governmental authority so that it couldn't be concentrated and abused. And that kind of division led to the now ancient and age-old fight between the state writers and the centralists. But what I'm talking about is something different. We've learned, especially in the last 8 years, that when we have these great programs dealing with the problems of people, that to try to operate them from Washington doesn't always work, and that it would be helpful if we're to focus these great federal resources in the most meaningful way, in accordance with the widest possible set of priorities on the problems of the people themselves. It would be better if we could develop viable and effective and progressive government at the local level as well as the state level. And in addition, we must find new kinds of governmental institutions, especially in our great metropolitan areas and in cities, which will make it possible for citizens in neighborhoods, blighted neighborhoods, or poor neighborhoods, or other neighborhoods, to make their own contribution to the development of governmental policies which direct the shape of their lives. This is an exciting and dramatic challenge, and may I say, that you young people, as well as the black people of America and the other disadvantaged people of America, by your protest in this election year, have opened the eyes, I think, of more and more Americans, indeed, I think, of a majority of Americans, to this great need for reform in order to transform our governmental system to what the founders initially envisioned. A government truly operated by, participated in, and governed by the people themselves. To give you some idea of the magnitude of the task. At the present time, the federal government makes available to state and local governments in the fields of education, health, highways, economic development, air pollution control. This is an area which he's going to turn over to me. And I can't think of a more exciting thing to do in the next 4 years than to build a federal system which is truly operating, not from Washington, but from the level of grassroots America, by citizens who are concerned, interested, active, and increasingly enlightened and skilled in the practices of the arts of freedom. Now that's where you young people come in. I know you're concerned about the war this year. Some of you may be concerned about some of these other issues. But let me warn you about something in your own lives out of my own experience. My college years were spent from 1932, the depths of the Depression, until 1936. And we of my generation were stimulated and excited by the magic activist leadership of a new president who undertook to grapple with the problems which were blighting the lives of the American people in those days. And while we were in college, we were active, we were interested, we were bold. But what happened when we left? It was 10 years later that I got involved in politics for the first time. I waited 10 years to translate on a continuing participating basis the interest and concern that I developed as a student into some meaningful participation. Now, when you leave, Carl, you're going to be beset with the problem of making a living, getting married, raising children, or with some of them, by public support. And you don't build public support by ignoring the people. You don't build public support by indicating a distrust of the people. And you can't build public support by being afraid to enter debates for fear that they may dissipate your lead. A man who's afraid to lose his lead as a result of debates hasn't got very strong convictions about the message he has for his people. They tell us this Nixon has changed, that he's new. Well, as far as I'm concerned, when you've seen one Nixon, you've seen them all. I know, and even as it's described in his own campaign literature, has been completely uncreative, uninspired, unconcerned about these problems of people with which the next president must work. The record of the administration in which he was vice president was a negative one in terms of these problems. His president vetoed two housing bills, desperately needed in the city. His president vetoed two area redevelopment bills, desperately needed to stimulate the growth of backward areas of the country, both rural and urban. His president vetoed a modest increase in our program to control water pollution, a problem which obviously is going to command resources of a magnitude to stagger the imagination. All of these problems were neglected in those 8 years, and Mr. Nixon has said that he's willing to be held fully accountable for the policies of those years. We need positive, creative, strong, inspired leadership with a record behind it. And that's the kind of leadership offered by Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota.
Manchester, New Hampshire, October 25th, 1968.
Those who are still seeking to find hope for improvement for themselves and for their families and for their children. The Nixon record happens to coincide almost exactly in terms of years with that of the Vice President of the United States. So there is a background, an experience, which you can compare. Nixon was a member of Congress with the Senate for 6 years. With an opportunity during that time to indicate the areas in which he was interested and concerned. Well, it's interesting that in his own campaign literature, he makes no claim for achievement during that 6 year period. You can see it here. Just two lines on his congressional record. One, that he won the Senate seat in 1950, and two, that he was endorsed in 1948 by Democrats and Republicans for re-election. No listing of legislative goals that he tried to achieve. No listing of legislative achievements. But he can talk up to the record. Then he served 8 years as vice president. Some of you are old enough to remember that in the last week, the campaign of 1968 was not one significant contribution Mr. Nixon made to the administration. The president's five orders give me a week and I might take the one. What was the record of that administration? We had three recessions, which cost us $175 billion of national production. This meant, obviously, the rank and file Americans were less able to provide themselves with children for their education than they would have been, but for that loss in production. But it also meant that America, at all three levels of government, was less able to provide the schools, the hospitals, to build the manufacturing plant, the resources of the skilled people who are devoted to their country and their state, who are progressive, who want the best educational system for their children, who recognize that if New Hampshire is to move ahead, it will require us to have the best trained people coming out of the best schools, using whatever natural resources we have, clean water, transportation, and all the rest, to the advantages of atomic energy. And he concluded by saying this: there is an old New England saying, a rising tide that lifts all the boats. And I believe that the boats of New Hampshire can only be raised when the boats are being raised in the rest of the country. What did Jack Kennedy do about it? He kept that tide. He turned the tide. It rose, it raised the boat. Your old people here in New Hampshire, what harm it has done, and what good it has done. As Vice President in 1960, he refused to cast the vote as Vice President that would have moved a federal aid education bill through the Senate. His administration vetoed two housing bills, essential to rebuilding of our city. His administration vetoed two area redevelopment bills, necessary to stimulate the economic growth of the backward areas of our country. His administration vetoed a bill to increase our investment in water pollution control. The amount that was vetoed was a pitiful fraction of what we need, what we now know we need to deal with this problem of water and air pollution. Complete lack of sensitivity to the ferment that was brewing under the surface of life in metropolitan America, in our cities indeed, across our great land. Americans who did not have a state were moving toward it, seeking it, seeking to find ways to achieve it. Now here in the 1960s, we created an affluent America for most Americans, but there are still Americans who are on the outside. The question faces us in this campaign: what do we do about them? How do we deal with their problems? Do we do it in the old American way of building a country that provides opportunity for everyone? Or do we shield ourselves off from them and their problems and their striving and their dreams? Well, that answer is as old as the history of man, and it has never worked. Whenever a society is trying to shield off the disadvantaged and the deprived in order to protect the affluent, the ultimate result has been an explosion, which has brought insecurity and violence to everyone in this society. Our answer to this age-old problem the founders of our country understood that it was an answer to that age-old problem, was to build a united country in which all people can aspire to opportunity and improvement.
Capability.
their mind, their heart, their skill to shape a political system in which as many Americans can participate as want, and which is as responsive to the voice as well as the need of American people as we can make. So we need your help. To an extent that I can't remember in my lifetime, at least not since I was a common student myself, young people are involved, at least in their hearts and minds. This year is a great issue. What we need is to get their involvement in the political process as well. On a continuing, day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year basis, even through the years of immediately following your college, when you're going to be preoccupied with the problems of marriage, family, children, and making a living. Those are the years when you want to be involved. I waited 10 years after I got out of college before I got involved. And there were a lot of things happening in that 10 years that it might have happened differently. The college students of my generation had stayed involved from the time they graduated from college, but we just did not. So learn that lesson from us, as well as the lessons that our mistakes teach you, the mistakes we made once we became involved. The great, great land we have here. No country has ever made it possible for the average citizen to shape the direction in which it will move as has this country here. So let's move.
They're going to turn to the human hungry as a man who ought to be the
next president of the United States. We're different from each other in so many, many ways. And yet without understanding, how do we make a free society work? The problem is, I think, illustrated by the problem any one of us has in his private life, in judging whether or not to do business with another man, or to give another man your patronage, or whether or not to enter into a contract or a partnership with another man. Before you get involved in that kind of a relationship, which carries its costs as well as its benefits, you like to form some kind of a judgment as to the man, his character, his capabilities, his intentions, his motivation. And it isn't easy to do. When you move into a neighborhood, a new neighborhood, which is going to be a large part of your life for a few years, you're interested in knowing what kind of people your neighbors are. And that can be a time-consuming process, because it takes time. Getting them to listen in the first place. The problem is complicated. And so we get hundreds of letters from those who hate, those who love, another human being without ever knowing him personally, without ever having any personal contact with him, without knowing anything about his life or his record. Well, if this happens with respect to people who are in the public eye as political leaders, as responsible officials of government, how much more complicated it is for a nation of 200 million people to know and trust each other. And yet without that trust, how can we make it work? How can we make it work? And it isn't an easy thing to do. Trust someone you've never seen 3,000 miles away, of a different color perhaps, different educational background, different tastes. And yet this society won't work unless we learn how to do that. We've got to be willing to take chances with each other. We do it every day, in one way or another, gambling, taking risks, taking chances. But somehow it always seems more difficult to take chances on people than to take chances on horses. Or to take chances on people than take chances on the weather, or on the crops, or on the market for our goods. And yet the most important chances we need to take are those we take on people. Especially in a time like this. Americans are deeply suspicious of other Americans, deeply distrustful of other Americans. And we've got to find some way to overcome it. And there's no way to do it by passing a law. There's no way of doing it by a president or a governor enacting an executive order. There's no way to do it but in the hearts and minds of Americans themselves. So the election really is going to be decided in the hearts and minds of the American people. In the process, they're going to elect a president and a vice president. Which brings me to my next point. I'm running on a ticket headed by a man I've known and trusted and respected and believed in. For the 10 years I've personally known him in the Senate, and for the entire quarter of a century of his public life. I understand the difficulty that many Americans are having in seeing through all the controversy with which he's been surrounded in this past year to see the real man. And I just want to say to you, my friends and neighbors of Maine, that he is a real man. Chance to meet him, to look into his eyes and his face, and to hear his voice, and feel the grip of his hand, you'd feel the same way about him as I do. And the reason is that on personal contact, what is inside a man comes through. A good man somehow emerges as a good man to people who meet and know him personally. An evil man does as well. It's the men who fall in between who create problems for us. But as I consider the three candidates for the presidency this year, and the problems that they're going to face, the problem of somehow inspiring the American people to trust each other, to take chances on each other, to work with each other. As I consider the things that must be done to heal the divisions among our people, as I consider the enormous problems we face to make our cities livable places of opportunity, the problem of eradicating poverty and all of the crime and the disorder and the unrest that arise from it, I'm certain that the next president needs some very important qualities. He needs the capacity to understand. He needs the capacity to care. He needs the ability to develop ingenious, creative, effective ways of bringing people together and of applying our great resources to the problems which are the greatest. Important qualities. Hubert Humphrey has those qualities. His record above the records of either of his competitors documents what I'm saying. From the time that he was elected a youthful mayor of Minneapolis in the 1940s, for the next quarter of a century, he was working with all his heart and mind, with compassion, intelligence, understanding, and a creative genius, and persistence to solve these problems. He began the fight for Medicare almost alone in the late 40s, a fight that he finally helped win in the 60s as majority whip of the Senate. He began the fight for federal aid to education when he first went to the Senate. That fight was finally won in the Senate in the 60s. He began the fight for civil rights legislation to strike off the chains those slaves we freed in the 60s of the last century, but who were not yet free. And he began that fight in 1948, and in the process, driving out Strom Thurmond, who walked in. And that same Strom Thurmond
who rejected a Democratic convention determined to fight for human rights, was embraced by this year's Republican presidential candidate in this year's Republican convention. That says something about the two candidates for president. It says something very important about the two candidates for president. Something that ought not to be overlooked by those Americans who understand that we must heal the division between Americans, whoever they are. Oh, it's a great challenge that we face in this country, not just in this election year, but in the years ahead. We made freedom work during the easiest year of our national existence, notwithstanding all the difficulties through which we've come. Wars, including a great civil war, the absorption of 40 million immigrants, the Industrial Revolution, two great world wars. None of those pose the kind of problem that we face here today. And to put it in its starkest, simplest terms, we have the question of whether or not Americans who already have a stake in our society, we're already enjoying our apples, are willing to share with those who do not. Or any other legislation that you can conceive of, that answer won't work unless, in addition to insisting upon law and order, you do something about the conditions which make the have-not Americans restless and dissatisfied with their lot. And I'm not talking about charity. I'm not talking about handouts. I'm talking about people who live in conditions that no one in this room would accept quietly and passively, without resistance. I'm talking about our self-interest, yours and mine. Do we want to live in an orderly, peaceful society? There's only one way to do it. We've proven it for 180 years, and for the life of me, I can't understand why we should begin to doubt in the year 1968 what our own experience teaches us. So many of us here, all of us, I think, are descendants of immigrants, and we ought to know from the experience of our own family that human beings are going to fight to improve themselves and to get out of ruts and out of ghettos and out of slums. You would and I would. And to pretend that you can somehow suppress that urge by a phony definition of law and order is to overlook the plain facts of history. This idea of shielding off the well-to-do has been tried over and over again in history, and it's never worked. It's always led to trouble for the affluent as well as the poor. Those great historians, the Durants, tell us that it's inevitable in history that the rich will get richer, that the poor will get poorer, and that when the gap gets big enough, the society explodes. And they tell us that in their monumental history on the life of man. They just issued a small volume summarizing their findings, and this is one of them, that this inevitably happens. We must not let it happen here. We've had the one answer in history which makes it possible to avoid that answer here, if we'll just understand the lesson and practice it. When I consider how much more average Americans have today than we had when I was a boy, we weren't affluent, but we weren't poor, and we were happy. Now, what we've added to that since is more than enough to share with those who have nothing. And the question is whether the affluent are ready to share with the poor. At a time when the affluent have never had more, and the poor have never had less by comparison. So are we going to prove that history can be wrong? Or are we going to prove that the American answer can be right? That's the question. And at the risk of sounding like a preacher, the single most important word is trust. Trusting others and trusting that they will not injure you in return, but prepared to live with that risk. That's the way we've done it. That's the way we can continue to do it. And I think that Jefferson was right, that if you make this kind of appeal to the average human being in a free society, that he'll respond not with meanness or selfishness, but with greatness and generosity. And that's what I'm banking on in this election campaign. And thank you all.